Okay, welcome, dear listeners, to another edition, actually episode 34 of the Jacobs podcast. We're really getting into the 30s now, which is really good stuff. And we're going to do an episode today on Papua New Guinea, and joining me is Jordan Shopper. But before we get into it, I just want to remind listeners that about rating the podcast or leaving a comment in on whatever platform you listen on, or even sharing with your friends or just giving feedback in general. I'd really like to hear from you at seanjacobs.com.au on ideas or tips for feedback. But then as well, as I mentioned, whatever platform you listen to the podcast on, whether it's iTunes or Anchor or Spotify, just make sure you rate and leave a comment as well. It's a really good way to get exposure. So as I mentioned, this is episode 34, and we're going to be looking at Papua New Guinea, which is actually, well, firstly, I'd like to welcome WIG Capital's Jordan Shopov. Jordan, welcome.
G'day, Sean. Thanks for having me back again.
No problem.
How are you? Mate?
Yes, really good. And I was sort of listening back to a few snippets on Warren Buffett, and I really enjoyed last week's episode on him, because, and it shows a bit of versatility. We're jumping from Buffett to Papua New Guinea, and just the range of issues we've covered in the past 30 or so episodes has been pretty cool.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun doing that last week, but I'm looking forward to sitting back and letting you do the heavy lifting on this one, because I might not have that much to contribute, but we'll see how we...
No, cool. I think you'd be surprised about how much you can sort of weigh in.
Make up.
Well, I was going to say weigh in, but fill in the gaps. But I think there's a lot on PNG that... that goes into development economics, about growth, about getting out of a stationary state, inflation, you know, running the economy, the, you know, corruption, how to run a state effectively, all these sorts of things that tumble out of, you know, PNG's always been a good, I guess, test case, I think, for, you know, if you want to study the growth of a country, cultural difference. It's such a fascinating part of the world, and, you know, one, of course, that I've got a lot of affinity with, being born there, mum being from there, a place called New Island Province. And I didn't spend too much time there in my youth, but have worked in a number of capacities there throughout my professional life over different times. And yeah, it's, I think, quite a fascinating part of the world, and pretty opportune time to actually just talk about it. I know you and I have spoken about doing one on PNG for a while, but they've just had a new prime minister come in, James Marape, who's an ex-finance minister, who took over from ex-prime minister now, Peter O'Neill, who was prime minister for 7 years, I believe, seven, eight. So he'd been in the position for a while, but this just happened in the last couple of weeks. So it's actually quite a useful time, I think, for people out there who want to know just a little bit more about PNG, much like yourself, I suppose.
Yeah, well, like you were saying, it's a, you know, something like PNG is a really interesting topic from a development economics point of view. And so maybe some of my Adam Smith can come to bear and help me out on this. But I've been meaning to grill you in a proper session about PNG, given your family background and your history and how much you worked there and stuff. Because it is it's an interesting country. So, but before we get into the politics and the development stuff, you were saying your mum's from New Island Province. Mm-hmm. So, your mum, you know, she doesn't live there anymore, or she still lives there?
Yeah, so she is kind of in between at the moment. So she lives with my sister most of the time in Adelaide, and commutes back and forth a fair bit. But she's currently up there at the moment, actually, and we've still got property and a few different interests up there. And, you know, the overwhelming majority of mum's family is still back out in the village, as well as in Port Moresby, which is PNG's capital. So, I've still got extensive family ties up there and a few different interests, etc.
So what's the longest period of time that you've lived in PNG for?
Probably about a year or so. Oh, well, no, a couple of years, actually. Yeah, yep.
When you're a kid?
Yeah, mostly. And then spent a lot of just elapsed time living, you know, going back over the years. And then... when I worked there about 9 years ago, I was coming back and forth out of Port Moresby a fair bit, so I was doing a lot of fly-in, fly-out. And then when I was working up on Manus as well, at the processing centre up there, was FIFO, so I was going 3 weeks on, 3 weeks off, and then spending a bit of time in Port Moresby in between as well.
So how far is your mum's hometown from Port Moresby? Is that close or?
It's not too far. It's about an hour's flight. So in the northeast kind of thing. So New Island province. But you can't fly there directly from Port Moresby to Kavieng. You have to sort of do a bit of a milk run around and hop around the other islands around the sort of in an anti kind of clockwise direction to get there, but as far as a direct flight, it would be probably just under an hour.
So it feels pretty removed, even though it's only an hour away.
Yeah, well, that's one of the sort of characteristics of PNG. It's kind of a very remote, like there's a lot of inaccessible parts of the country on the mainland. For example, in the Highlands, it's very rugged terrain. Port Moresby is one of the only capital cities, or I think the only capital city in the world. I've just been told this. I'm not sure if it's actually accurate, but I think it's pretty fair. That's not accessible by road to any other major townships. So the closest other city/town by PNG standards is Leigh, and that's you can't get to it by Port Moresby. Pardon me, but it is actually on the mainland in Papua. So most of the other, and you know, there's quite a distinction there between New Guinea and Papua, so the mainland and the islands, the people were sort of quite distinctive, the cultures are too, to a large degree. The islands are, not accessible unless, you know, of course, by boat makes things a bit easier, but lots of parts of the mainland where Port Moresby is and the PNG Highlands is pretty rugged terrain and pretty remote.
So do the people who live out in the more remote islander regions, do they kind of see themselves as different to people who live in the capital, like the people who live in Port Moresby?
Yeah, well, look, I think one of the big challenges with PNG is because there's about 800 plus languages. I believe it's got the most languages out of any nation in the world, and about 1,000 plus culturally distinct groups. So you know, naturally, in a modern state like that, when you've got so many different cultural groupings, you'll have, I guess, a lot of difference. But I think PNG as a state has done quite well to hold itself together, and I think a lot of that has to do with the Westminster institutions that have been put in place by Australia when we administered Papua New Guinea. And then, of course, before then, the British and the Germans had interests there. But, there's a lot of difference in PNG. And I think PNG, you know, politics is really centred around the managing difference and being able to manage that difference in a cohesive institutional framework, which is what is extremely challenging. And I guess we've seen some of that sort of political wrangling over the last few weeks and the alliance shifting and what that can actually mean. For in this case, changes to the executive and the prime minister.
So it sounds like there are a lot of different competing factions that are very highly fragmented, so it makes it almost a little bit chaotic because you're trying to bring all these people together in one melting pot.
Definitely, yeah. Exactly. And I think it makes, you know, governing very difficult, makes consensus building very difficult, and it makes, I think, probably a cohesive philosophical platform for a political movement very difficult as well. We of course have two sort of major parties, Liberals and Labor, and you know, some of the minor parties is coming into things a bit more, but that dominant tradition is just never, political tradition has never been around in Papua New Guinea. And again, I think it comes back to that sort of fragmentation and the difficulties around forming grand alliances. That's not to say that that doesn't exist in the culture. I think, you know, consensus building is a huge part of Melanesian culture and, cohesion and things like that. But I think when it rubs up against other groups that are kind of like that as well, and you transpose that onto a political setting, and especially when you want, you know, a modern state to be an impersonal service provider that, you know, collects taxes, builds roads, balances the treasury books, these sorts of things, then it makes things obviously very tricky in that respect.
Just on this governance point, you mentioned that Australia kind of had administrative responsibilities for PNG after the English. How long did that go for? Was that was that a sustained period that we actually were kind of overseeing PNG?
Quite a while. So actual British responsibility was started in the late 1800s. So, and then people sort of forget that we weren't a federation or a nation until 1901. So it was kind of this, and then as soon as that, as soon as that actually occurred, I think about 1906 or so, it was handed over from the Brits formally to the new nation then of Australia. Germans had an interest as well in the sort of the northern part of New Guinea. Then, of course, we had World War One, and then during or following that, and especially following that, all territorial responsibility was handed over largely to Australia. So I guess it's been sort of post-World War One where Australia's had quite, an overwhelming territorial responsibility for Papua and New Guinea. And it wasn't until 1975 that PNG achieved full independence. But it was more or less operating like, up until then. I think there was the Papua New Guinea, or the PNG Act was probably in the late 40s or around then. Certainly after World War II, I think it was 1949, that was made governing a self-responsibility, largely running like a state there, with obviously a lot of colonial oversight from the Australian government. But it wasn't until 75 when full independence was achieved.
So does this mean that up until the early 40s, there was kind of like an administrator from Australia that was running PNG? So, kind of like how John Copperthwaite was running Hong Kong for the British?
There was actually what the colonial administration did was actually set up district administrators, or what were called KIAPs. So basically KIAPs were kind of like a catch-all leader, an administrator, a health worker, a diplomat, a policeman, a judge. It was sort of an all-of-the-above type role, and their job was to actually, have territorial responsibility for different parts of the country and actually look after certain villages. So you'd have a district administrator for a certain district, obviously, and they would be responsible for, judge, jury, executioner-type responsibilities, in that fashion, so it was kind of a really interesting arrangement where you had and still a lot of the country lives this sort of a very localized village lifestyle, meets a new economy to a degree, but then largely untouched or touched only sometimes by a modern state as well, and outside ideas, of course, from a lot of Christian missionaries from especially in the 1800s.
So what was the impetus for PNG going independent in 75? Was that a local movement, or was that something that came from Australia's
side? I think it got sped up a lot by, it was definitely, there was an independence movement in Papua New Guinea, but I don't think it's kind of as strong as what we would romanticise it being like, it wasn't, Kwame Nkrumah and Kenyatta in Africa, where there's a groundswell and a huge sort of movement for independence. You didn't really sort of get that in Papua New Guinea. I think what I get from reading the history around that time was that there wasn't a huge push for it. It was anticipated to be something that would happen in the future. This is sort of as late as in the 60s, basically. PNG wouldn't be achieving independence until it could stand on its own. They could build the appropriate capabilities. They could get Papua New Guineans to step into sort of leadership responsibilities and be able to run. So that was seen as very much a future thing. And then Whitlam, 72, was part of his election platform. He was very enthusiastic about decolonisation at the time, and as part of his... And, why wouldn't he be? Because that was where a lot of progressive politics and was at the time, in the 60s and 70s. Globally, it was just something that Britain was kind of doing and Australia was into as well, about decommissioning the empire and moving to a commonwealth and giving a lot of former colonial states independence. So it got sped up, from what I understand, a lot more quickly than what was anticipated in the 60s and early 70s.
So to play devil's advocate here for a moment, because I know that the general strain of history is that decolonization is a good thing and giving countries independence is the right way to go. Looking at it with hindsight, do you think that the shift was the right way to go at the time? Like, are there things that have happened in PNG which might have turned out differently if independence hadn't been granted at that stage? Like, would there have been benefits if it had stayed kind of more under an umbrella of Australia?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting one because you can't, in a lot of places, you can't say that, colonisation was a good thing or independence couldn't have been granted quickly enough. But I've road tested this with a few people who were around then, family members, other people who had, and this is sort of the other thing to mention as well, that because, like you've noted, we've had such a joined at the hip history and for such a long time with PNG, although not many people, I think, of our generation kind of appreciate it to the same degree as previous ones have. There's a lot of people that have, who have a connection to PNG or a degree of separation. Oh, my mum worked there, or, my dad used to work there on the mine. My grandfather, fought there. There's a lot of connection to the country where people have some idea of what it was like in living memory in those colonial days. From what I can glean, a lot of things got ran very effectively. You don't see the kinds of, corruption. You didn't see the kinds of breakdown that you do see today around, basic services, health, education. On all these sorts of indicators, I think, things were better pre-1975. And there's lots of reasons for why that's unraveled since then. But I think, on the face of it, it would just be too difficult to sustain a long-term argument for hanging on to PNG, from an Australian foreign policy and I think philosophical perspective as well.
Yeah. Noel Ferguson's book, Empire, is probably one of the very few, arguments out there in favour of that, keeping the colonies. But putting that aside, the scenario you've kind of laid out reminds me a bit of how the Soviet Union transitioned to, the breakup and then Russia as we know it today. I remember reading that a lot of the goals at the time, like a lot of Western academics flew over and were like, what you need to do is build private property rights in all these institutions and that will give you a flourishing, liberal democracy. And it didn't work out. And a lot of the reason why is because there was this idea that you could just design the institutions from the top down and it would all work out. I'm just curious as to whether PNG had a similar thing. Was there were institutions kind of imposed in that independence moment, which kind of maybe stifled it, or actually might even worked all right? Like, what was going on around that time in terms of the founding of the governance structures?
Yeah, so it's actually interesting because you look back, and the other thing you hear about too is just how skilled the bureaucracy was. Like a lot of Australian civil servants and Papua New Guinean civil servants around then that were. The Department of National Planning, Department of Finance and Deregulation, the PNG Treasury, a lot of very effective institutions, which is sort of hard to sort of fathom now, but it made a lot of the, decisions around, let's just say, health and education. If you have a well-run education, well-resourced education or health department, it kind of makes, the running of hospitals easier. Schools, for example, with exercising a decent curriculum, instilling a good education. Those sorts of skills were, I think, it wasn't a matter of outside experts coming in and telling a bureaucracy how to run. It was literally people embedded in a bureaucracy who were part of the bureaucracy actually running the state as well. So it was a kind of a different approach, than what I guess the model we'd see probably in that you're referring to in terms of that, the late 80s, early 90s, a lot of when we had a lot of globalization or occurring, or a lot of countries coming out of command and control economies into a global economy. PNG was sort of coming out of that a lot earlier. Again, I think because of its connection to Australia and to the sort of thinking and ideas. One of the first pieces I actually got published was on back in 2013. I was just looking at this recently on when Margaret Thatcher passed away. So yeah, it was 2013. And just talking about how the application of her ideas around, you know, political ideas, yes, but more economic and fiscal ideas sort of permeated through out a lot of the Western world and touched PNG. And, you know, it would have been around that time in the 1970s and early 80s about denationalisation of key industries, keeping inflation under control, and then also taking on vested interests in the economy, i.e. or a la strong union movements, and making sure that, you know, I guess proper wages or a market economy wages paid to people and not artificial wages, or getting that balance right. And you can really see a lot of those fiscal ideas and some of, yes, some of those political ideas permeate throughout PNG in the 70s, in the 80s, and I think which certainly set PNG up for a decent success in the long run, vis-a-vis if it hadn't been prepared for those things 25 years later or in the 1990s.
So in those early years, or actually going straight to that independence moment, was there, you know, elections held from day one, or was there like a puppet PM that was put in? How did it actually play out?
Well, from memory, there were actually elections taking place already in the country. So it wasn't like 75, the ribbon was cut and or the flag came down. It was kind of, all right, what do we do now? So again, things were up and running before then, where I forget what was actually the Prime Minister's. It wasn't actually the Prime Minister, but, you know, it was given another name. But things were technically running like a state before 1975.
And you said before that though, PNG kind of adopted some of the Westminster systems. Mm-hmm. Can you give me a brief rundown of what the PNG Parliament actually looks like, and whether there's local governments and states and things like that? How does it actually work?
Yeah, so good question. There's 22 provinces. There's a unicameral national legislature, so a single house. There's no Senate.
Like Queensland.
Yes, that's right. So it's a 111-seat member parliament. So you've got, let me just think about this. So yeah, you've got 22 provinces plus the National Capital District, which is kind of like DC, you know, Washington DC, which is where Port Moresby sits, so the capital. And then you've got 20, so you've got governors of all of those provinces. They all sit in the National Parliament. So basically like a senator from the United States sitting in as an MP. And then you've got all of the open, what are called open seats, so 90 open seats in the legislature. So yeah, it's kind of a mixture of governors of provinces plus all of the 90 open seats, which are electorates around Papua New Guinea. They did used to have, and I can't remember the exact years, but they did used to have provincial legislatures, so like state legislatures, but they were disbanded whenever it was. I believe it was in the 1990s, if not the 80s, because of corruption and basically the model not working effectively. And yeah, you can definitely see some pitfalls with that approach. So it's very centralised, PNG's governance system. There are local level governments as well, but not state governments to the extent that we'd appreciate or we see in Australia.
So it sounds a little bit like New Zealand in the sense you've got a lot of local governments and then one centralised parliament. Is that a fair statement?
Good point. I sort of never really made the comparison. Yeah, it's that's right. So no state parliaments, but yeah, you've got Port Moresby and then right down to the local level as well.
And those governors, the 22 from the provinces, are they democratically elected or are they kind of more like tribal leaders? Is there a difference
to
the
other? No, there's not. So they're democratically elected.
So this might be a good segue into what's currently going on there today. Because all I've read in the newspaper is that O'Neill's in hot water, and has he been kicked out? Is that the latest?
Oh yeah, so or... he was facing a vote of no confidence. So he stood down a couple of weeks ago. Julius Chan was a sort of interim, not prime minister, but he was sort of put in place as someone who was sort of taking care of, the hand on the reins kind of thing. And then they took a new vote. So the new prime minister is James Marape, as of a couple of weeks ago. So he's been prime minister for a few weeks now. And he was the ex-finance minister in the O'Neill government.
Oh, so he's actually still O'Neill's party?
Yeah, he defected.
Okay. How long was O'Neill in power for, and kind of what's been the circumstances around his downfall?
So 7 years. So he was, when we were both at Chogham, he was just came in, so that was in 2011 in Perth.
Yeah.
For listeners, that's a little brief aside. Jordan and I were liaison officers there when we were working for the federal government. So he was just recently prime minister then, so that was 2011. So if we sort of work backwards, so he'd been around for a few years, O'Neill.
Is that pretty long for a PNG prime minister?
Yeah, definitely. So they're 5-year terms, and the until 2002, the PNG prime minister had never served a full term in office. So that sort of just goes to show how votes of no confidence, which are legion, used to be legion in the PNG parliament, unfolded. So yeah, O'Neill, he'd been around for a while. As far as he goes in the modern political context, he's certainly been an effective prime minister in the sense that he's been able to hold his position, provide stability in terms of not having that sort of kaleidoscopic vote of no confidence, be at the rudder for 7-8 years, almost a decade, pardon me. And I think he's been quite useful in terms of bringing PNG into the modern kind of world, in the sense that guiding some of the economic growth that we've seen and turning that political stability to a cohesive business environment, and responsible for seeing a lot of growth in Port Moresby and in Papua New Guinea that we otherwise wouldn't have seen, I don't think, if the political stability wasn't there. One of the things I think has been interesting to see is PNG articulate its strategic ambitions in a way that we sort of haven't really seen, at least in the 90s or 80s, to the same, in terms of actually articulating a foreign policy white paper or a defence white paper or a national security strategy. You can really sort of gauge or see these things, I think, as a casual observer from outside, to see the country grow and sort of go to that next stage of development where it's starting to articulate its strategic ambitions. And that happened under O'Neill.
Have you noticed, like over the last, say, 5-10 years, have you noticed the economic difference in PNG? Has it changed that much? Or can you see examples of the growth going on?
Look, if you just measure it by construction, number of businesses, number of places that, like, and restaurants, cafes, but like this local stimulation of business has been, I think that's just a sort of just a stand in the street kind of barometer, which I don't think is entirely not useful in terms of experiencing growth and economic growth. PNG has also been one of the fastest growing economies in the world. So gold, copper, nickel, a lot of it's underpinned by mineral growth or mineral exports, pardon me. And of course, LNG, liquefied natural gas. So PNG is a huge gas exporter. And it had, I think it was about $30 billion impact over 30 years. So quite a huge transformational impact in the PNG economy that we've sort of seen over the last few years and will probably see into the future, providing that the resource or there's still a strong demand for gas it continues.
So you've got a sense, like I get that's just like an anecdotal reference to what it feels like on the street. Like you can get a sense that it's become a bit more dynamic, but clearly that the resource side is where most of the growth has come from. The standard thing in development economics is the Dutch disease, where, you know, you've got this resources boom, but the once it ends, the country is dilapidated and has, you know, it's either not seen the benefits or they've just been wasted. Mm. Is PNG at risk of going down the same path?
I think a lot of people would say that and observe that. I think what I've been, though, is a bit more enthusiastic about the economic stimulation that these sectors can provide. And I think a lot of people are quite sensible about that. You know, we all know about Dutch disease and, you know, the crowding out of other sectors, the quick injection of cash, you know, into, you know, what's essentially in many ways pre-modern societies and what that, the disruption that can provide. But I think, you know, you look at how, you know, what is the alternative, I suppose, and, you know, I've written this, I've published pieces on this where I've been, you know, like what... It, you know, PNG is not manufacturing microprocessors, or, you know, it's not manufacturing aircraft, or it doesn't have a high, you know, like a finance sector or a service, strong services sector. Its comparative advantage in the world is resources. And that's where, you're right, the lion's share of economic growth comes from. I think that sort of challenge is how to recognize that and actually not entirely translate that into outcomes in other sectors, but recognize where the economy can leverage off that growth and therefore provide opportunities and growth in Papua New Guinea. So I guess I've been a bit more enthusiastic about some of those things and, you know, the creative destruction, to quote Schumpeter, that growth can provide. It's quite unsavory, but I think otherwise sitting in the stationary state is not a good place to be, because it, you know, causes stagnation and really sort of drives poverty as well.
Yeah, and it's, I think it's easy for people in Australia or other Western nations to kind of overlay their own sort of environmental or political standards on countries like PNG. And I got a taste of this when I was at my last job as a public policy consultant. And one of our clients was a major forester in PNG, and we were essentially retained to kind of fight back some of the arguments coming from the main environmental NGOs and so like Greenpeace and WWF and these guys. And the case we were making was simply that, you know, PNG is in a different stage, and, you know, you're right, they're not Silicon Valley. Their natural resources are there, you know, where they have a comparative advantage, and to take that away, you really, you know, like you said, leaving them in a stationary state. This is where they can get a leg up, and they don't have the same environmental standards as we do. Like, they're willing to accept that cost in order to get the benefits of growth. So, it's that to and fro between the cost and benefits, environmental degradation, which you have to take into account of if you're going to get that type of growth and development. But going back to the resources stuff, I can imagine one of the big issues with such a bounty is the corruption that can potentially come from mining royalties and leases and stuff like that. Has that been a problem in PNG?
Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely. You look at Transparency International's Corruption Perception Index, for example, and PNG is always at the wrong end of that ranking.
Yeah.
So, you know, corruption is a huge issue in Papua New Guinea. One of the things as well, I think, is a huge ailment, and I guess where to begin on these things, but it's, and you touched on it before, it's property rights as well. So, you know, when you're looking at things like royalties and who do you actually deal with to actually provide those royalties to, there's not a register of, you know, property owners. You know, a lot of resource companies do their due diligence, but it becomes quite tricky when, you know, it can often mean, know, who shouts the loudest, who makes the most noise, who can cause the greatest disruption, or who has a monopoly on power, not so much who's got the sort of native rights to the land, which naturally cause huge issues, but and rent seeking behaviour and all kinds of things. But, you know, to be fair to resource companies, they're actually, you know, this is not new stuff to them. They're, you know, I know a lot of people who've worked in that sector and industry in Papua New Guinea, and it's quite impressive the work that they do to actually work out who the specific landowner and do, you know, landowner mapping and these sorts of lineage mapping and work out, like, who actually is a landowner and who isn't, and therefore who is in line for royalties and benefits. But that's a huge investment to actually make, and you have to get really good people in to do that work. But you know, that doesn't, you know, there's again a lot of space and opportunities there for malfeasance and corruption that no doubt occurs.
Yeah, and like none of these major, whether it's an oil company or an LNG company or whatever, none of them want to get caught on the wrong side of corruption. I mean, they were all trying to do their best to manage that risk, and that's why there's such a premium. Well, sorry, they discount the opportunities quite heavily because they know that's a big issue. Mm. So, yeah, but like you said, property rights is the big one, and without a fully developed government and bureaucracy, these things are always susceptible to tribal conflicts or whatever you want to call it. And I think that's, again, going back to the environmental NGOs and organisations like that, a lot of the issues around degradation and deforestation and stuff like that, a lot of them can be solved with better property rights, but they don't get created overnight. It's a very local thing. Like, I can imagine that what property rights constitute in some of the islands are different to some of the inland areas or around Port Moresby and stuff like that. Is that a fair enough thing to say?
Yeah, I think it's just whatever it is, it's just the whole idea of a property rights regime is that you can have a pretty clear indication of who owns what, and it's title, it's on paper. But you do hear instances of people producing two different titles to the same property that both look legitimate. And when you have a confused property rights regime, it obviously, yeah, like you say, it doesn't do wonders for economic growth or using capital for making business decisions based on what physical, what capital you actually have, and proving that on paper, which is what an effective property rights regime essentially does. But yeah, it is, I suppose, a little bit different, but in different parts of the country. But yeah, the outcomes just sort of come back to again butting heads with a modern state and the overlay of having a property rights regime put on top of it, a Western one versus a cultural pre-modern one.
Mate, just to delve into the weeds on this subject a little bit more, have you read anything by Eleanor Ostrom?
No, I haven't.
So she was the first woman to win the Nobel Prize in Economics, and she won it for her work around institutions like property rights. She did a famous speech at the Institute of Economic Affairs about the tension between public ownership and private property rights. And essentially she was saying that it doesn't have to be mutually exclusive. There is, if you go and do the analysis of a lot of local institutional arrangements, they're a combination of both. And so she spent her career studying like Nepalese immigration systems and stuff like that. And a lot of her work showed that every culture, every local society, every local polity comes up with its own set of institutional arrangements to stop the like overfishing and deforestation issues, like the common pool resource problems. Okay. And I think her work is really, really amazing in terms of making people recognize that. I mean, I have a bias more towards the private ownership of property and thinking that will set the right incentives so that resources don't get degraded. But she was kind of pointing out that you don't necessarily need that, and you don't need complete public ownership either, because that usually leads to the wrong incentives as well. Every specific culture will have its own sort of tastes and preferences and ideas about what is equitable and fair, and that in itself will lead to a certain arrangement of rights of use and rights of access and things like that. I think her work's fascinating.
That's right. I think like a lot of the, this is why a lot of community development in PNG is very much focused on community ownership or the community designing a solution to something, it not being imposed from outside, because you can sort of try that, but then the wheels fall off after 6 months or whatever it is. So it really has to be an organic kind of process. And yeah, that's right. So I'd love to read some of Ostrom's work, because I do think like you can find problems of fit a lot of the time with something that's transposed onto a localized setting. But then other times you can find a cohesive way for these things to work together, which I think is a nice sweet spot, and probably happens in a lot of instances in PNG that we don't really sort of see when we look at corruption perceptions indexes or look at the political woes or the headlines we read out of the country. So I think it's a fair point.
Yeah, I like the term you use, the organic way of resolving these issues. I think that's a great way to describe the type of solution she's talking about. Just bringing it back though to kind of the present day. So putting in context all these economic issues and challenges that PNG has, how do you see things going forward? Like, is this political machination kind of a sign of progress? Like, are you bullish on PNG's future going forward, or are you a bit more pessimistic?
Well, in truth, I grew a bit used to seeing Prime Minister Peter O'Neill there, and I think he was a kind of person that provided a strong leadership for the country and an unusual level of stability politically anyway. So I'd be really cautious about being too bullish or optimistic at this stage, and I mean that because I think the last thing that we need is, or PNG needs, is to have a lot of political volatility, especially now when they're on the cusp or in the very sort of on the doorstep of this LNG or this gas resources boom and the kind of opportunities that can bring. So it's very much a wait and see, I think. But I just sense that with economic growth comes an opportunity to rebuild and to remould things and provide opportunities that once otherwise weren't there. And that kind of dynamism can drive a lot of outcomes that maybe aren't specifically designed as part of an assistance program or a foreign aid package or program, but can lead to some pretty organic social and economic outcomes, and spin-off activities and churn can create a lot of opportunities in a way that we can't design, or we can't sort of want to channel from outside, that they could produce a lot of good outcomes for Papua New Guinea.
I'm not sure if you already answered this, but so what was it that actually did O'Neill in? What was the vote of no confidence for? Was there a specific issue, or is this kind of like an internal party thing?
I think it was just kind of what people say is just he became a bit too authoritarian, or like a bit too kind of my way or the highway, and less consultative on...
A bit too Kevin, is that what you mean?
Yes, that's right.
The kitchen cabinet.
Yes, yep. Probably a lot less frenetic than Rudd, I would imagine. That's the sort of broad feel or the consensus, that not being consultative enough. And in the words of James Marape, I think he said not doing it the Melanesian way and being consultative.
So he lost the confidence of the party room kind of thing.
Yeah, and just all of the alliance. And I think they just got critical mass with people walking out of the cabinet, people walking out of the alliances. And what that actually caused was, enough to sort of break the camel's back.
Mate, just to jump topics for a second, on foreign policy, what is, we've obviously talked a lot about Australia and PNG, but what is PNG's relationship with its other neighbours? Like, do they get along very well with the Indonesians? Or what are their kind of strategic interests in the modern era?
Yeah, so PNG shares a land border on the mainland with Irian Jaya, which is obviously Indonesia, West Papua, where that is the Free West Papua movement is something that's been, it seems to sort of grown a lot of notoriety. Again, the people are very distinctive in that part of Indonesia. They look very much like Papuans because essentially they are, because the land border is split like literally down the middle. If you look at Papua, it's cut in half, and one side Indonesia, one side is Papua New Guinea. They've had, things used to be pretty bad in terms of the skirmishes that used to happen along the border there. In some parts of the Irian border, I've never been to that part of the world, but it's not sort of clear where the border actually is. There's been some, second guessing by both sides where, shots have been exchanged, that kind of thing. But never anything on a grand scale. There's been a few disruptions with the Indonesians over the years about border skirmish stuff, but very low level. But that's on sort of one side. People forget as well, of course, Australia, PNG's Australia's closest neighbour. We've partners in development, got a long natural history there. There's, you know, parts of Cape York you can throw a stone into PNG waters and vice versa. So, that's another interesting aspect of PNG's foreign policy. PNG a few years ago has had this sort of ongoing idea to join ASEAN, so the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, which is very much kind of like Turkey joining the EU is a good sort of comparison. It's not a bad idea. It kind of makes sense economically. It's kind of this huge kind of mass that you can see in the corner, just putting its hand up, going, we can be a part of it. We should be quite probably useful economically. But then it just sort of doesn't work politically. There's questions about geographically. Is it quite there? It's kind of the same pitfalls that PNG kind of suffers when it's put in bids to join ASEAN. So that's kind of been an interesting thing. APEC, which was hosted, the Asia Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum, was hosted by PNG in Port Moresby late last year. And that was a huge, huge thing for Papua New Guinea to host. It's kind of like Brisbane hosting the G20, but almost on steroids. It was actually a huge event for PNG to host a forum like that and to be put on the national, or put on the international radar. So there's a few sort of forums where PNG's been quite active in, where it's, again, like I said at the start, articulating its intentions a lot more in a foreign policy sense. But I think naturally, as the country's grown and been one of the fastest growing economies in the world, it's actually surprisingly reached out to a lot of different nations and, very far afield, and has gotten a bit more notice and traction than it otherwise would have had, say, 10, 15, 20 years ago. So it's steadily building relations as the country actually grows.
Does it have trouble getting membership in these trade blocs because of its, protectionist issues it has, or is it more a political thing?
I'm not entirely sure, really, but I just sense that it's probably more of a political risk, political volatility element versus things being sharply protectionist. I think the economy is actually quite open in a lot of respects there.
Just back on West Papua, because I know nothing about West Papua. So the, what are the conditions like over in West Papua? Because I presume it's nothing like Indonesia. It'd be more like PNG, wouldn't it?
Well, this is an interesting one, because I remember reading a paper a few years ago where it actually cited the numbers. So it's a very interesting situation. So you have West Papua administered by Indonesia. The Free West Papua movement has a lot of, a lot of political opposition from Jakarta in a very sort of brutal way in a lot of respects, which is what I guess you would expect from, in that part of the world where you don't want to be testing, the Indonesian government on running a succession movement. It's probably not a wise thing to do in terms of a strategy, but that's been, pretty unsavory in terms of some of the things that have happened there. Also, so you would sort of naturally expect in an environment like that, more people would be pushing into the Papua New Guinean side as refugees. But the actual numbers that I've seen, I'll try to dig this out, is it's actually the other way around. You actually have more Papua New Guinean people illegally living on the Indonesian side of Papua, which is kind of interesting, but not entirely when you look at things, because the Indonesian side of thing, and this paper did make this sort of comparison and this commentary, it's actually, much more effectively run. Things are much more effectively administered on the Indonesian side in terms of, and all the sort of flow on effects of what that means: better roads, better schools, more successful commercial operation, a better governance regime, better security in a lot of senses as well. So you can sort of see that it kind of flips assumptions on their head about, people suffering persecution going one way out of a country. But when you actually look at the numbers, it's the other way around. But I'll try to dig out that paper and drop it into the show notes if I can.
I presume as well that West Papua, you were saying at the start that PNG has got something like 200 different languages and all these different sort of tribal areas, is I presume West Papua is also very similar. So there's no sort of like cohesive bond between the East and the West. It's really fragmented in both sides. Is that fair to say?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And again, I think that's why it's been tricky to build any sort of alliances in Papua New Guinea, where you've just got such cultural fragmentation and that sense of affinity. On the other side of things too, like in the complete other end of Papua New Guinea geographically, is the province of Bougainville. So the other big thing in PNG's history is in the Bougainville Civil War, which ran from the 80s to into the 90s, I think it was 88 to 97, and about 20,000 lives were lost. I think there's probably a lot more that aren't officially accounted for in that 20,000 amount. But that's, the autonomous region of Bougainville is a part of Papua New Guinea where there'll be a referendum on succeeding as a state in PNG. And it's kind of, that's kind of a mixed sentiment, I think. There's a lot, it's not as crystallizing as what people think, with people want Bougainville to be part of Papua New Guinea, or it's hard for people, in other parts of the country to build any sort of, affinity for Bougainville to achieve independence. And I think a lot of that is around that cultural fragmentation and that, I guess, lack of affinity with other groups in the country that actually manifests itself there.
How big is Bougainville, population-wise?
You're putting me on the spot. I don't know off the top of my head. Sorry, Jordan.
I can't imagine they'd be, like, it's big enough to sustain itself in a lot of ways. It'd be pretty small.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. I think one of the benchmarks is actually showing that they have a viable economy to be an independent country before holding the referendum. So,
they sit with gold deposit or something.
Yeah. Well, they did have copper. So, Bougainville copper, huge, that provided I think half of the country's revenue at one stage before the Civil War. So huge reserves of copper, that obviously went wayward with the Civil War that erupted there.
Yeah. Okay, mate, a left field question here. If you were a dictator for a day in PNG, what would be the first thing you'd do to try and put it on the
Well, I think Milton Friedman was asked this question and he was like, I don't want to be dictator.
That's the answer you could have given.
I just think there's probably something in education, like something about I've always thought about something that needs to touch a lot of Papua New Guineans, and especially the sort of next generation, is some of the values that are rewarded in a capitalist or a growing economy. Where, prudence, hard work, virtue, all of these sorts of things are rewarded in a growing economy. And it's not to say that those things don't exist, but I think those can be hugely effective reminders to a lot of young people. You look at Rockefeller, for example. You look at a lot of, Carnegie, Dale Carnegie. It's like all of these people, these ideas manifested themselves in young men when at a time of the late 1800s, when the US was experiencing a lot of churn, a lot of growth, a lot of things that PNG is experiencing now, and a lot of that growth was really kind of unsavory. But you look at what the prevailing values and the belief was among people, and it was kind of like what virtues and what attitudes and behaviours and priorities do well in a growing capitalist economy. And I think, there's something in that about being able to broadcast that, whether it's being able to put something into the curriculum or being able to distribute a copy of something like, Booker T. Washington's Up From Slavery to every Papua New Guinean household, I think would be a good way to go. Enlivening that self-belief and, that putting your best foot forward when it's not always easy, especially in a growing economy.
And I guess everything you just said could apply to Australia as well. It's like really just this idea of progress and betterment, and it's a cultural thing. Mm. That's kind of what I took away from what you said there. And you reminded me of Deirdre McCloskey's work around economic development, which is this idea around ideas are what shape growth and progress. And maybe, like, yeah, you referred to like Rockefeller and the early American century where these ideas of progress really took hold. Is there something in P&G's culture today which kind of stands out to you, whether or not it's a, you know, something that you think will drive its growth, but is there something that really that distinguishes P&G culture to Australian culture or other cultures in general?
I think it would probably go back to what I think the challenge is having that the multitude of cultural groups makes it a unique challenge in a way that probably, but not to the point of being so unique that it's not, you know, but I do think it does put it in a special kind of category in terms of having, trying to balance competing interests and build consensus. That's a challenge, of course, everywhere. It's not just exclusive to P&G, but I just think the sheer volume of that in a place like P&G makes it a kind of a unique challenge. And then plus, I think the geography and the terrain has always made things, you know, economic growth a bit difficult there, in a way that, you know, like a lot of other places have done quite well. When you look at geography and economic growth, there's, you know, a lot to be said about having a city on a major port or, you know, an accessible navigable waterway, for example, and open to international trade, and you look at the ripple effect of that over time. But yeah, it's, and you know, P&G, a lot of the parts of P&G don't really have that connection to the outside world, and you know, you look at the challenges that's presented over years and years, and it's quite difficult, but again, not entirely unique. But that's why I've sort of tried to pull in where I can in my sort of earlier writings about showing that P&G is not unique in the sense that it's facing a lot of, you know, how to build consensus, how to, you know, stamp out corruption, how to make sense of economic growth, what happens when you've got a huge resource sector but not other sectors are firing. All these sorts of challenges are ones that P&G faces, but a lot of other states face as well.
Yeah, it's interesting how you're saying that actually it's probably the cultural diversity, which is probably its, you know, distinguishing characteristic. I find that really interesting.
Yeah.
But I think that exhausts all the questions about P&G for a while.
Yeah, cool. Well, look, thanks, Jordan. And it was interesting. You put my knowledge to the test on a few different things there. So I imagine I'll have to print a few corrections in the show notes. But yeah, like, that was good. I appreciate it.
Thanks, mate. I learned a lot. I'm ashamed to say I haven't asked you. I should have asked you about this type of stuff a long time ago.
It's been a pleasure. And I think, you know, it is, I guess, a blind spot in terms of a lot of Australians and their knowledge on the world. You know, you think about neighbours and there's New Zealand, other parts of the South Pacific. But, you know, P&G is actually, you know, just over 8 million people live there now, more than New Zealand. So it's a huge, huge country, you know, very pretty and very diverse, of course.
Huge potential.
Yes, that's right, exactly. And I think that potential is unlocked by growth.
Amen.
Cool. Well, thanks again, Jordan. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for tuning in to another episode of the Jacobs Podcast. Reminder to please get in touch with me at seanjacobs.com.au. Or please rate the podcast or leave a comment on whatever platform you listen to, or share the podcast with your friends. We'd really like to build things up and continue building and growing. So thank you, dear listeners. Thank you, Jordan. And until next time.